You're tuned to WFHB
91.3
and 98.1 FM.
Volunteer powered,
listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Welcome to WFHB's Daily Local News.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers from the Bloomington community.
And supported by the generosity of listeners like you.
Good afternoon from the studios of Community Radio 91.3 FM. Reporting live for WFHB, this is Leah Carter.
And I'm Don Guerra. This is the Daily Local News for Tuesday, September 13th, 2016.
Every effort at incentivizing the local economy in this way results in the elimination or disappearance of a certain group of people.
A local group is leading an effort to oppose development of Bloomington's proposed tech park. We'll speak with organizers later in the show in today's WFHB Community Report.
Also coming up in the next half hour, the ins and outs of money, our weekly segment providing economic education and community resources that keep your budget balanced and your finances flourishing. But first, these local headlines.
Park South, a mixed-use development planned for the southeast corner of Hillside and Henderson Streets, is moving forward after receiving approval from the Bloomington Plan Commission. In its meeting last night, Development Review Manager James Roach outlined the proposed development.
The mass of the property, the vast majority of the site, would be developed with three new buildings. Those buildings would include 6,400 square feet of commercial space immediately at the corner of Hillside and Henderson, a total of 74 apartments, associated parking and sidewalks, and a multi-use path along Henderson Street, and adding in street parking to both Hillside and Henderson.
Mark Lockley, whose family is developing the property, promoted the aspects of the project related to energy efficiency and sustainability.
Sustainability and lowering our carbon footprint. Again, we have a 40-panel PVs, which is a solar electric system, which will offset the needs of our new office within the commercial development, a solar thermal system which is sized appropriately for the commercial, which will take the hot water needs of all the commercial tenants except for a restaurant, rainwater catchment system of 2,000, and I said plus gallons because we're looking potentially to increase it if we can within our budget.
Lockley said the commercial building will be built to LEED silver specifications, and the residential buildings will include energy-efficient appliances, reflective roofing, and large windows for natural light. Recycling will also be provided. A separate maintenance building will be topped with a 1,000-square-foot green roof, complete with a beehive. Lockley said four of the residential units will be designated low-income housing as part of the HOME program, which is run by the city's Housing and Neighborhood Development Department. Four of the six houses currently located on the property will remain. Parking has been a consistent issue in previous reviews of the plan. Roach said staff conducted a study of alternate parking within a three-block area north and west of the planned development. The study found that on more than half of the days when parking was surveyed, 40% of the spaces were available. Mark Cornett, who lives on South Dunn Street, said the city's parking study was misleading.
The standards that are cited in the packet from the planning staff don't tell a real story about parking conditions and the need for parking. Elm Heights Blooming Foods met the parking standard. They're closed. I'm sad that they're closed. I'm very sad that they're closed. I think people that lived in the area are sad that they're closed. This wishful thinking that biking and pedestrians will support retail in and of themselves is wrongheaded. The cars do all the heavy lifting. The convenient maximization of on-street parking is the key to retail success, period.
John Lawrence, who represented the Bryan Park Neighborhood Association, told the Plan Commission that many area residents are concerned about the project.
The following are items we requested and are still we are still very concerned about. So remove the suburban detention pond. It's still included in the project. It's a suburban solution in an urban area. It doesn't make sense next to a school and doesn't belong in an urban area. Create architecture that is of size and bulk to fit the context of the neighborhood. Building C was 4 stories tall. When we complained about the inappropriate height of Building C was reduced by a story. But Building A then increased by a story. It was as if it was a balloon. You pushed on one half of it and the other half popped up. The building's just out of character for this neighborhood.
Lawrence said the Neighborhood Association's primary concern is for the success of the commercial developments at the intersection of Hillside and Henderson. Several council members expressed conflicting feelings before ultimately approving the plan. Commission member Joe Hoffman agreed with Mark Cornett that parking was still a concern.
I think that's likely to be something that we are going to have to be addressing very, very soon as this project develops, if it's approved. And so that for me is the toughest issue. I don't think the building is going to stand out in the way that some people have described it, but I think the parking issues are more significant than just what happens on this particular site, and I think we have to be prepared to deal with it.
Council member Isabel Piedmont-Smith supported the development, but said it was a difficult decision because she represents residents who spoke against it. During its 4-hour meeting, the commission also tabled a site plan for a 4-story mixed-use building at 113 North Dunn Street that would house the Bloomington Bagel Company with 16 studio apartments above it. The Plan Commission approved a site plan titled Tech Park Housing, located at 619 North Morton Street, adjacent to the Trades District. The development would contain 13 studio apartments and one-bedroom flat. Stay tuned for more on the proposed Trades District coming up later in the show.
The Indiana Supreme Court has issued a new rule that could dramatically reduce the number of Hoosiers held in jail awaiting trial. The ruling mandates that arrestees should be released without any monetary bail requirement unless they meet a new set of requirements. The decision is the result of a study committee established by the court in 2013 to find ways to reduce jail expenditures. Under the new rule, which is derived from the findings of that committee, persons accused of murder or violating probation or parole terms can be required to pay bail. But in order to impose bail requirements against anyone else, judges and prosecutors must use evidence-based risk assessments to show that a defendant is a flight risk. Those requirements are effective immediately in Monroe County and several other counties, and will be expanded to the entire state by 2018. Jailing defendants who are awaiting trial is a huge expense for county governments. Roughly 70% of inmates are being held because they were unable to pay bail. Under the current system, bail is imposed automatically, with amounts determined by the crime that defendants are charged with. The courts will now have the ability to set bail amounts themselves, but most first-time and otherwise low-risk offenders will likely be subject to automatic release without paying bail. The new system hinges on risk assessments, which are meant to serve as an unbiased means of determining which defendants are low risk enough to be released without a bail requirement. Exactly how those risk assessments would work is unclear at this time. Many cities around the country have switched to using a computer algorithm to determine risk-based factors like age, criminal record, and previous failures to appear. Advocates of algorithm-based risk assessment say the system is an improvement because it forces impartiality by taking the human factor out of the picture. In theory, eliminating racial or class bias. But some advocates of criminal justice reform have argued that computer models could serve to codify existing biases under the guise of impartial data. Indiana's current risk assessment system uses structured interviews to collect data about criminal history as well as other factors like family support, substance abuse, and a category titled Values and Beliefs. These social categories are often left out of newer computer models. Over the past 2 days, WFHB reached out to several officials in the county court system, but was unable to get any comment from them.
Elizabeth Bett Savage, Bloomington's Volunteer Network Director, has been appointed to serve a 3-year term on Indiana's Serve Indiana Commission. Governor Mike Pence made the appointment. A City News release announced Savage's appointment to the 25-member commission that advocates, reviews, and adjusts the state's position on issues related to community service and volunteer sectors. Savage will work to advance volunteerism and distribute funding in support of Serve Indiana's programs throughout the state.
The City of Bloomington Commission on the Status of Children and Youth is seeking nominations for the second annual Students Who Act Generously, Grow and Earn Respect Awards, also known as the Swagger Awards. The awards honor youth who have a commitment to certain causes or have displayed actions that have improved lives, and is open to students who live or attend school at MCCSC. Mayor John Hamilton will present the award to the winners on November 15th. Nomination forms are available online at www.bloomington.in.gov/CSCY, starting tomorrow. Nominations will continue through October 14th. More information can be found by calling 812-349-3851. Reporting live for WFHB, I'm Leah Carter.
And I'm Don Guerra. The Bloomington Solidarity Network describes itself as a volunteer network of working people who defend each other through collective action. The network has recently led public defenses of tenants having trouble with landlords. And recently, the group has also begun organizing in opposition to a project they say will harm future renters in Bloomington. That's the city's proposed certified tech park. That project would be located on the north side of downtown. The affected area stretches from 7th Street north past 11th Street. On the east, it's bordered by Morton Street. On the west, it stretches past Fairview. The city hopes to turn the park into a home for local technology companies, as well as a place for employees and others to live. But the Solidarity Network sees problems with that plan. For today's WFHB Community Report, News Director Joe Crawford spoke with two organizers from the network, Matt Gias and Adam Scutan. In this next clip, Scutan speaks first.
As a organization that works for the mutual benefit of tenants, gentrification is sort of the long game. You know, we could fight all these small battles day to day, but if we're not fighting these larger structural problems, then we're ultimately fighting a losing battle. So that's why the Certified Tech Park, or what is now or will be called the Trades District, got our attention. Effectively, it's being built close to areas which are some of the last relatively affordable places to live in downtown Bloomington. The Maple Heights area has been one of our focuses, but the Near West Side and extending all the way to Crestmont down 11th Street. And what the Certified Tech Park will do is, by developing that land, will raise the property values all around it, make the cost of living go up all around it, while all the benefits go right back into the tech park. And Matt could probably talk more about the tax element in that. But we view it as a large project, basically funded by taxpayers, organized by the city, that is like a gift to tech companies that will have negative effects on residents.
What a city government essentially does when it creates like this certain tax zone, it creates what's called a redevelopment commission. And the redevelopment commission finds areas in a city and says, like, this is in a state of disuse. And when they claim that, they're allowed to create a zone that's financed by tax increment financing. So they find this zone and they call it a TIF zone. And what they do is assess the base property value. Let's say it's like $1 million, and then begin redeveloping this real estate or this property. And what happens most often is that they do this in order not to create anything of like communal value, but to incentivize private businesses to take residence in these newly renovated buildings. So then a new tenant comes in who, let's say, is some kind of private company, which increases the property value even further. And within this TIF, tax increment financing zone, the city of the Redevelopment Commission, is able to collect the tax money, what's called equalized assessed value, an EAV, and take the original assessed base sum of the property, let's say it was $1 million, and let's say it increased because of this new private business, this tenant that moved in, to like, let's say $20 million. The city is able to collect all of that tax revenue and reinvest it back into the TIF zone.
Geographically into that specific area.
Yeah, exactly. And the Redevelopment Commission is like the sole proprietor of this money. The city doesn't use it for any other community purposes. It's used exclusively for this one TIF zone.
Let's talk about what the arguments typically are for TIF districts, as well as the arguments for the certified tech park. And the gist of it is that folks who support these projects say that they bring economic development, which will help the entire community. It will bring companies that will have jobs, and it will bring more people who have money to spend at local businesses, et cetera, et cetera.
Every effort at sort of incentivizing like a local economy in this way, in this very like centralized private way, results in the elimination or disappearance of a certain group of people. In this case, it would be like the Maple Heights affordable housing area, because any sort of economic growth that would occur in this area would directly affect all of the surrounding property values. So the only thing that would happen is that rent prices for the people who need rent control the most would soar. Landlords who own properties in there, whose property values would go up themselves, would begin selling their properties to even to people who could pay these larger sums of money, and to other sort of more wealthy landlords who could buy the properties themselves and redevelop these areas.
There has been talk about some affordable housing as part of this agreement. Has that ameliorated your concerns at all?
No, it hasn't really ameliorated our concerns. In fact, I would say it's a well-crafted way to sort of sweeten the deal in the way that sort of mystifies what's actually being done. Economic development, what it usually means is that is the enrichment of the few for the further impoverishment of the many. So we're given the claim that there will be jobs added, that there's extra tax revenue, and that it will diversify downtown residency. And the last part sort of speaks to what you're talking about. One of the ways that they justify this claim of diversifying downtown residency is to offer some allotment set aside for affordable housing, which is what the city sort of cynically calls workforce housing, quote unquote. And the actual first development project is the building of some senior housing where Bender Lumber used to be. This appears to me, and I think is pretty clearly an intentional way to make it seem as if this is a project designed for community needs and not just an incentive for large corporations. Because in the long run, the totality of the project is not at all geared towards making life more affordable in the area around the tech park. And the last part, and the one that most people tend to focus on, is will there be jobs added? The answer to that is I can't say there will be zero new employment opportunities, but I can say that most of the employment opportunities that would be created are for people with a high level of technical education. So specifically, not the majority of people who are living in affordable housing in the area. And two, that the businesses which are targeted to move into the tech park are already established businesses.
So there is that land there that's not really developed right now. What would you like to see done with that land?
We've definitely had a lot of discussions on alternatives for that land. I want to say that any proposal I would like to see, and I think we'd all like to see, to organically come out of sort of the popular movement against the tech park, as you know, what people who live in that area want to see that land used for. One option that has been floated and has seemed very popular, and this is not officially what the Solidarity Network is proposing, but it seems very popular, is the idea of putting a year-round shelter there.
Bloomington really, really needs.
Yeah, it's a vital need for the city. We don't have a year-round shelter anymore, and so far the only response that the city has come up with, which is always their answer, is to further police poverty, further police homelessness. Recently, Mayor Hamilton has proposed putting in more police officers and security cameras. And I would also just like to say that it would be just fine if that land was used just for events. Like, nothing necessarily has to be built there. I drove by it today and it was being used for a baseball game. So we see those things as people-first options.
That was WFHB News Director Joe Crawford speaking with two organizers from the Bloomington Solidarity Network, Matt Gias and Adam Scouten. The group has begun organizing in opposition to plans for a certified tech park on the north side of downtown Bloomington. Gias and Scouten say the network has already canvassed at hundreds of homes in the area and has plans for future action. Coming up next, WFHB's weekly financial segment, The Ins and Outs of Money.
It's The Ins and Outs of Money, presented by the It's Your Money Project at Monroe County Public Library. Quick tips for getting control of your money, no matter how big or small your income or family is.
Hello, and welcome to The Ins and Outs of Money. I'm Christina with the It's Your Money Project at Monroe County Public Library. Last time we talked about bad habits to avoid in order to protect your identity. Things like leaving everything in your wallet, forgetting to update your passwords, and not cross-shredding your personal documents. This week we're following up with more proactive steps that you can take to make sure your identity is as protected as it can be. Tip number one, limit using your personal data on social media. You love the barrage of happy birthday messages on your special day. But it is a good tip to never put your full birthday on any public forum. After all, it is one of the main questions asked to verify your identity. Full addresses and phone numbers are also best left to private messages and kept off of websites. Tip number two, use consumer fraud protection. Oftentimes, when you're affected by a large credit breach, the compromised company may offer you fraud protection as a way to gain back your trust. It is a good idea to take advantage of these offers while they are available, so that you can have added protection for free. They usually cover you for a year or more and include the following. First, you get standard fraud monitoring. The offered service monitors the standard three credit bureaus, Experian, Equifax, and TransUnion, as well as credit cards, public records, social security numbers, bank accounts, medical records, and sometimes even social media. They search these sites for anyone trying to create accounts or conduct transactions using your information. Often, they will even send a text message, email, or call you when activity is occurring. Keep in mind that transactions like obtaining a driver's license, payday loans, or medical care are not put through these types of vetting systems immediately and may still be vulnerable to attack. You will also commonly receive $1 million in fraud insurance. This usually only covers lost wages from taking time off of work to deal with the theft, phone costs, notary and certified mailing expenses, and occasionally the use of an investigator or attorney. It does not cover any financial or physical losses resulting from the identity theft itself. However, these are most often covered by the vendor in the breach transaction or the financial institution itself. What about choosing to pay for fraud protection yourself, as opposed to the free year of protection the credit card company offers? These services can be beneficial, especially if you suspect that your identity has been compromised, and you'll typically get quarterly or monthly credit reports to review. If you have no reason to suspect your identity is at risk of being stolen, though, there are differing opinions as to whether or not it's worth the $10 or $15 a month you'll pay for fraud protection. A good alternative is to go the do-it-yourself route. Number one, be sure to frequently check your bank balance, as often as once a month to even once a week. You are looking to make sure that you know what every charge on your account is. And remember, no charge is too small to pay attention to. Oftentimes, identity thieves will make small charges on accounts to test their viability prior to making a larger charge months down the road. Two, get your credit report at annualcreditreport.com. This free service is federally mandated and is supported by the three major credit bureaus. This site will not ask for any payment information and will give you a complete credit report. It doesn't give you your credit score, but it's still a very effective tool for discovering whether someone is trying to open a line of credit in your name.
3. If you suspect that something may be happening on your account, you can pay a small fee to freeze your credit for 90 days. This means that no one can be extended a line of credit with your information, including you. Remember that to lift the freeze, another small fee is required and it takes a couple of days to process. And finally, tip 3, update your spam and malware. An entire internet service provider being hacked may seem common, but in reality, it is a pretty rare occurrence. But the same cannot be said about an individual computer on that provider's network. It's much easier for your machine to become compromised with malware, and it doesn't matter if you have kept up with your rigorous passwords. If there is malware on your computer, your login information might be recorded and sent to whomever is attacking you. By keeping your security software up to date on both your computer and your mobile device, you can help prevent either from being compromised. Stay tuned next week. We will be talking about ways to keep your information safe when shopping online.
The Ins and Outs of Money is part of the It's Your Money Project at Monroe County Public Library. It's produced by Ryan Stacey at Level Up, the Digital Creativity Center at the library. Executive producers Joe Crawford and Dan Witherid is our sound editor. Music courtesy of Flannel Graph Records. Tools for taking control of your money can be found at money.mcpl.info. That's money.mcpl, as in Monroe County Public Library.info.
You've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB. Today's headlines were written by Joe Crawford, Jared Dill, and Kathy Norton, along with Sarah Vaughn for Cats Week, a partnership with Community Access Television Services. Our feature was produced by Joe Crawford.
The Ins and Outs of Money is produced by Ryan Stacey and associate producer Christina Wiltsey. It's part of the It's Your Money Project at Monroe County Public Library. Our engineer is Rob Schoon, and our theme music is provided by The Impossible Shapes. Executive producer is Joe Crawford. For WFHB, I'm Leah Carter.
And I'm Don Guerra. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered, listener-supported, independent daily news program. You can hear tonight's full broadcast as well as all other WFHB news programming online at WFHB.org.
You can be a part of our award-winning news team. For more information about joining our volunteer team of citizen journalists, email news@WFHB.org.
Stay tuned for Interchange, Bloomington Community Radio's longest-running public affairs program, coming up next on WFHB.
The Daily Local News is produced by a staff of over 50 volunteers
working in the WFHB News and Public Affairs Department.
Comments, suggestions, and story ideas
may be submitted directly to our news staff via email.
The address is news@wfhb.org.